the words, "I'm sorry," can be seen as the two most powerful words in the English language, but they can also be the toughest to say.
That's according to Harriet Lerner. She's a nationally recognized psychotherapist and relationship expert, known for her work on the psychology of women and family relationships. And she's the author of 12 other books, including The Dance of Anger.
And her new book is Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. She joins us now. Harriet, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm glad to be here.
What makes apologies such powerful and sometimes complicated things?
Well, first of all, it's so important. We're all connected. We all screw up. We all unwittingly hurt other people just as we're hurt by them. So the need to give and receive apologies is with us until our very last breath. And if done well, the apology is deeply healing. And if the apology is absent or we muck it up, it actually can put a crack in the very foundation of the relationship or even end it. So it's a really important topic, and it's very important to get it right. It's very easy to get it wrong.
Let's get into how to make a bad apology, because you spend some time on that in the book. What are some of the ways that we faux apologize, that we say things that sound like an apology but really don't convey that message sincerely?
The most common way is with the word "but." I'm sorry I yelled at you, but you provoked me. I'm sorry I forgot to call you on your birthday, but I was totally snowed under with work. It doesn't matter if what you say after the but is true. The but makes the apology false. It always indicates some kind of excuse or rationalization. So the first thing would be to get your but out of your apology, and no pun intended. And then the second most common way is when we apologize for the other person's feelings and reactions, rather than apologizing directly for what we said or did or didn't say or do. For example, "I'm sorry that you were upset that I corrected your stories at the party." That is not an apology. There's no accountability there. So a real apology would be, "I'm sorry I corrected your stories at the party. You've told me that you don't like that. I was totally wrong, and I won't do it again." And the list goes on.
You give a lot of examples throughout the book, anecdotes from people you know, yourself and others. One common thing that seems to come up a lot is that often in an interaction gone wrong between two people, there's some offense on both sides, some harm caused by both parties and received by both parties. And it seems like that is one of the toughest situations to sort out an apology, because we might have the sense of justice. Well, if I'm going to apologize, maybe they should apologize too.
Exactly. For example, in my marriage to Steve, I like to apologize for exactly my part of the problem, as I calculated, of course, which is never more than 47%. And I expect Steve to apologize for his part of the problem exactly as I calculate it. And we often don't do the same math. And that is simply one very common apology problem, where each person wants the other to apologize first because they're vying for the position of the one who's more to, you know, who's more to blame, who started it. And it really does take a lot of maturity to care enough about the relationship to be the first to accept responsibility for our part of the problem, without a hint of evasion, excuse-making, or blaming, even when the other person can't do the same.
Or even maybe you make your end of the apology in a magnanimous spirit and then eagerly leave the table open for them to take their turn, and maybe they do or maybe they don't.
Right, exactly. Maybe they do or maybe they don't. But, you know, we always stand on higher ground when we are able to be our best selves and not just act in reaction to the other person's immaturity.
Talking to Harriet Lerner, author of the new book, Why Won't You Apologize? Talking about the power of saying I'm sorry and some of the roadblocks to doing it. I want to talk about a couple of extreme cases, Harriet. First of all, the person who never apologizes, who never admits culpability, wrongdoing to anyone. Often, you're right, the person who does the most harm to begin with. How, if we're the person on the receiving end of that person's treatment, how can we approach that?
Well, first of all, most of us can apologize, and we have trouble in particular situations. For example, many people have trouble apologizing in a relationship where they feel overly criticized. There are too many criticisms and little corrections, and it's hard then to apologize when we should in that kind of situation. But we'll apologize with other people and in other situations. The entrenched non-apologizer is a person who walks on a tightrope of defensiveness above a huge canyon of low self-esteem. In order to apologize for a really serious hurt, we need to have, we need to stand on a great, big, solid foundation of self-worth. And from that higher vantage point, we can look out at our mistakes and apologize because we can see our mistakes as part of a much bigger, more complex, ever-changing picture of who we are as a human being. But people who do serious harm stand on a small, rickety platform of self-worth, and they're unable to get it. They're unable to see the harm they've done because to do so would threaten them to collapse into an identity of worthlessness or shame. And no one can tolerate that. So it's very important for those people who want to confront a serious harm, say with a parent or a family member, to understand that the response you get has nothing to do with how much that person loves you. What it has to do with is the amount of self-worth that that person has to draw upon. So it's important to understand if you're opening up a conversation with someone who's going to wrap themselves in defensiveness and minimization and denial, that if you're going to speak because you need to hear the sound of your own voice saying what you know to be true. Because the apology that you're longing for may not be coming, you know, not now or not ever.
We're talking to psychotherapist Harriet Lerner. Her newest book is Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts.
And we want to hear from you. What's important to you when you're getting an apology? Do you have trouble bringing yourself to say I'm sorry? And do you have a method of apologizing that's worked well for you? Has a meaningful apology helped maybe repair a relationship in your life? You can tell us about it at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking about the value of a good apology with Harriet Lerner. She's a nationally recognized psychotherapist, and her newest book is called Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think makes for a good and effective apology, and a bad one for that matter? Do you have a way that you have apologized in the past? Has a relationship in your life been saved by a good apology from you to someone else or vice versa? Do you feel the need to say sorry to someone in your life? You're struggling to find the right words. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Harriet, we've talked some about what makes a bad apology. People have come to you asking the question, I've had a rift in a relationship in my life. I know it's at least partly my own fault. What do you tell them about how to make that step and make a good, solid, effective apology?
Well, I probably wouldn't give them instructions, but I would certainly be very interested in their capacity to really listen to the hurt or angry party that they want to apologize for. That's really the hardest part. You know, we're wired for defensiveness. And what the hurt party really wants to hear is not just the words, "I'm sorry," which, by the way, can be a quick way out of the conversation. Like, "I told you 5 times I was sorry about the affair. Why do you keep bringing it up?" What the hurt party really needs, if we're going to give a healing, heartfelt apology, is they need us to listen. That we need to say, "Yes, I get it. Your feelings make sense. I screwed up. I want you to know that this is not going to happen again." But that doesn't have meaning if we haven't really listened. So maybe the most important thing I would want such a person to know is what I just said, that no apology will have meaning if we haven't listened carefully to the hurt party's anger and pain, which is so difficult to do because we're wired for defensiveness.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Sharon on the line in Walworth. Sharon, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Sharon?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually a first-time caller. I have a question. I have an 11-year-old son. I just recently divorced. I have 3 little ones. I have 11, 9, and 7. I also have an older one, but he's not a part of the divorce. Anyway, my 11-year-old, he's very passive and accommodating, but he constantly is apologizing for everything. If he sees me upset or if he sees somebody else upset or just any circumstance, he's always like, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." And I just was wondering, I tell him, I say, "Son, you don't have to apologize unless you've done something wrong or made a mistake. You don't need to apologize for everything." And I'm constantly trying to reassure him and affirm him and love on him. And, I just was wondering, what do you say about that? I mean, how do I convince him or guide him and direct him and stop apologizing and being so passive and not standing up for himself and just honestly taking the burden for other people's mistakes as well?
Sharon, thanks for the call. And Harriet, I know this is something you might spend time with a client on, talk a patient for a long time, but generally for a young person who's over-apologizing, it sounds like, do you have some general words of advice?
I would say, Sharon, to not worry about it. And of course, post-divorce lasts a long time. A lot of behaviors of children are going to be very exaggerated. And it sounds like you have done a very good job letting him know, that he really doesn't need to apologize for something unless he really has done something that he thinks is wrong. And since you've told him that, and you've told him with clarity, I would defocus on it. I would not be concerned about his behaviors. I would stop correcting him about the over-apologizing. Because sometimes the more we focus on a child's behavior that we believe is problematic, it actually will exacerbate the behavior. So I wouldn't worry about it. And what I would try to do is to keep the lines of communication open around the issues of the divorce. You know, what's the hardest thing for him about the divorce? And to be very clear with him, and of course all the kids, that he's not responsible for anything about the divorce, that he didn't cause it, he can't fix it, that his job is to have the best relationship with you and his dad that he can have, because it's possible that the over-apologizing relates to, you know, kids often unconsciously feel responsible for everything that occurs in the family. So I wouldn't worry about this. I just wouldn't worry about it, Sharon.
Sharon, good luck to you and your family, and thanks so much for making that first call. We'll go next to Rob on the line in Madison. Rob, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about Rob?
Well, I'm a part-time chaplain, and a lot of what I do is I deal with people who either themselves or their families have to come to a point of forgiveness as a person is reaching the end of life. And I've found that there can be kind of a paradox between apology and forgiveness, in that in order to achieve the latter, the former can be either a great first step or it can be a meddling factor. And, you know, I guess I would like to, if there's a way that I can professionally avoid the meddlesome apology to achieve forgiveness, I'd like to be able to do that. Does the guest have any advice for achieving forgiveness with or without apology?
Harriet, any thoughts?
Well, in my book, Why Won't You Apologize, Rob, I have a chapter called You Need to Forgive and Other Lies That Hurt You, because there are many routes to finding peace of mind without forgiveness. And I think that when people believe that there can be no peace or healing without forgiveness, and this is the only path to a life not mired down in bitterness or hate, it leads to problems. Forgiveness is not always a cheap gift. For some people, it has to be earned. And a colleague of mine, Janice Abrams Spring, has written a good book about forgiveness that I like. And one of the points she makes is that you don't necessarily restore your humanity when you forgive a non-apologetic offender. He restores his humanity when he works to earn your forgiveness. So I don't mean to sound like a big meanie, Rob. I have nothing against forgiveness. But when forgiveness is touted as the only path to healing, when people are told that they're a less loving and whole person if there are certain things they do not forgive, I see that as problematic. So I'm actually very interested in the forgiveness issue. And if you read my chapters, I would be very interested in hearing, because you are a chaplain, I'd be very interested in hearing your reaction.
Rob, thanks for that call. We're talking to Harriet Lerner about her new book, Why Won't You Apologize? Time for another caller. Terry is on the line in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Hi, guys. I wanted to chime in. I am a single parent of two teenage daughters, and occasionally, through providing guidance and discipline to both of my daughters, occasionally I will slip up and maybe say something that I realize momentarily later that, or moments later, that I may have said the wrong thing and hurt their feelings. And it might be easy for some people to do that and to walk away and not be concerned about the child's feelings. I find myself realizing that I have to quickly react to that error and apologize or reframe the comment that I made, which might have been hurtful. So that's my advice. If there are any parents out there, for me, this has been something that I realize is the right way to go.
Terry, thanks for the call. Harriet, we're just about out of time. But thoughts on making that apology sooner rather than later?
It actually does not matter very often. I work with parents who have said to their adult children, you know, I've been thinking about some things that happened 10 years ago around the time of, you know, the divorce. And I actually have been thinking that I was not very available to you at the time of the divorce. And I'm wondering what that was like for you, because I actually think about that all the time. In other words, it is never too late to open up a conversation and apologize to a family member for something that might have happened decades ago.
We'll leave it there. Harriet, thank you so much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
We've been talking to Harriet Lerner. She's a psychotherapist, a relationship expert. We've been talking about her new book. It's called Why Won't You Apologize? Healing Big Betrayals and Everyday Hurts. If you go over to the Central Time Facebook page, you can find a link to some information about her book. And while you're there, you can share your thoughts on apologies. What makes a good apology? What makes a bad apology? And is there a time in your life where an apology made a difference, helped patch over some problems, or would have made a difference? Is there somebody you still maybe think you ought to make that apology to? Again, find more info, share your thoughts, maybe your experiences over at the Central Time Facebook page. Now, if you visit Milwaukee's Estabrook Park today, you'll find a dog park, a disc golf course, a lot of green space to relax in, even a beer garden. It's hard to imagine that this area was once home to one of the largest cement quarries in the United States. Our next guest wrote a book that uncovers some of Milwaukee's historical sites and treasures that have been lost to time, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. In Milwaukee or beyond, do you have a story from your community's past? Are you a fan of trying to tease out the history of that local landmark? Call in at 800-642-1234. Carl Swanson joins us now. He's the author of the new book, Lost Milwaukee. Carl, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for inviting me on.
Well, Carl, tell us what set you on the path of tracking down these lost treasures of Milwaukee.
Well, history's a hobby interest of mine, but I think there's more to it than that. I don't think you can separate a city from its history. If you want to really understand your community, you might as well just start at the beginning. The whole process of researching, it just fascinates me. It's like assembling a jigsaw puzzle. You know, piece by piece, you start to build up a picture. And in my case, you know, the more I learned, the more questions I asked, the more I wanted to know. It's a wonderful process. History is just an incredibly rewarding thing. It unfolds in surprising ways.
And you say the first piece of that puzzle you write was a concrete foundation you found deep in the woods near the Milwaukee River. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's I live in the River West neighborhood of Milwaukee, and that's kind of what started the whole process for me. I enjoy walking the paths along the river, and there's a very large and very old concrete foundation and set of steps, and it's kind of buried in the woods. It was a real mystery to me. I think a lot of your listeners who are longtime Milwaukeeans are shaking their heads because, well, they know what it is. But I did a little bit of looking into it and discovered that it was the remains of the Gordon Park Bathing Pavilion, and that Gordon Park used to have a very popular swimming area on the Milwaukee River. And, you know, the more I found out about it, the more I thought, wow, this is fascinating. And started to distill it down and make sense of it as a story in my own mind. And then I thought maybe other people would be interested in knowing these sorts of things. So I started a blog, and eventually the History Press contacted me and asked if I'd write the book Lost Milwaukee.
Let's get into some of the more sites. And there's so many in your book, it's hard to know where to start. Let's talk about the Schlitz Brewing Company. Talk about the rise and downfall, and then what is left there today.
Yeah, when you're talking about the things in Milwaukee that are no longer a big part of the city, but were once a vast part of the city. I mean, Schlitz is one of the names that has to be right at the top of the list. It was an immense operation. Some years it vied for the number one brewery in the country. And now there's very little of it remains, just a few office buildings in downtown. But the story is an especially complicated one because they, of course, brewing is a very competitive thing. And they had a lot of issues going on. They were trying to cut costs with the product, and that didn't really work out at times. In fact, once they had to do a recall of the beer, their competition was fierce. Their marketing department kind of seemed to lose its way. The federal government launched a very expensive investigation against their marketing practices. And it's just, and then, you know, the CEO of the company unexpectedly passed away in the midst of all this. It's kind of one thing after another. They approached the workforce. They wanted concessions. They wanted pay cuts. Other brewers in town were giving raises. So the workers voted to strike, and that ended up being the end of Schlitz Brewing in Milwaukee.
And in the setup there, we mentioned Estabrook Park and the cement company. And cement, for a while, one form of cement was a huge business there, cement quarrying. Can you tell us a little bit about the story of the Milwaukee Cement Company?
Yes. It goes way back, and to a man in town who he is possibly the only person in Milwaukee who recognized the significance of some rock samples that were laying on the desk of the city engineer's office. They were building the foundations for the North Avenue Bridge, and these rock samples were sitting there. And George Berthelet looked at this. He was a man who made cement sewer pipe. And that meant that he had to deal with a cement quarry in Indiana and to have his pipe made. And he knew what natural cement looked like, and this was the stuff. And it was potentially extremely valuable. So he didn't want to broadcast this discovery, so he started quietly sort of poking around, looking for a place where the limestone cement ridge came close to the surface. And he found it in what is today Estabrook Park. And at the time, it was the world's largest cement quarry.
And then other means of making cement that weren't dependent on that one type came along. And then eventually this became one of the most dangerous swimming holes in the Midwest, right?
Yeah. Because they did quarry operations, they moved the bed of the Milwaukee River over to one side by building an earthen dike along the middle of the river. Then they mined out the bed of the river, which is where they found this cement limestone. Then they moved the river back where it was, but this left behind drop-offs and ledges and sudden holes, and it was just a particularly lethal place to go swimming. There was a place called Blue Hole, one of the lakes left behind on the west bank of the Milwaukee River, that had a particularly terrible reputation. Some people said it should properly be called Suicide Hole because it was just so dangerous.
Talking to Carl Swanson about his new book, Lost Milwaukee. He tracks down some of the lost treasures of the city. Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Plover. Mark, hi.
Hey there. You know how big cities have neighborhoods, and each neighborhood has a history. My mother spends hours and hours and hours of her life on the other side of that spectrum. All these little communities out in the rural areas that used to exist. This is where the butcher shop was, and this is the church, and this was the grocery store, and that was the community. Those buildings don't exist anymore. Those businesses don't exist anymore. But those places exist in the memories, and she's writing the history books for all of these little communities.
Wow, Mark, thanks for sharing that. So, Craig, a kindred spirit doing something like you're doing for Milwaukee, but for a rural part of Wisconsin. But that's true in Milwaukee, too, right? There are these neighborhoods and communities and buildings that are part of the history that if you drive or walk around, you have no idea they were there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm so glad that the caller's mother is preserving this history because, you know, that's it is incredibly important, I think, for us to understand our communities. We have to kind of understand how that community developed and grew and formed over time. And certainly it's true in Milwaukee that each neighborhood has its own distinct character and its own history and its own kind of folklore. And uncovering all of this stuff can be just an incredible detective story.
One story you uncovered along the way is something that we wouldn't think of now. We see bodies of water get iced up. That used to be a big part of the local economy. Can you tell us about the ice war of Milwaukee?
Yes, and you're absolutely right. Ice harvesting was a huge business in Milwaukee. It's a big city. It has major industries that at the time included meatpacking and brewing. All of these things needed ice to be kept cool before they had commercial refrigeration, and ice in enormous quantities. And so they had huge ice houses. Almost every community in Wisconsin had one. There were many of them in Milwaukee, including several on the Milwaukee River. And they had the dominant player in the Milwaukee market was Wisconsin Lakes. Ice Company was the name of it. And they had 300 people working on the Milwaukee River, dead of winter, 1900. And here comes a steamboat with steel ice-breaking plates on it, smashing up the ice as it goes up and down the river, and it turned out to be owned by a rival ice company. And so that was kind of an aggressive business tactic. And the people that were working on the river, there were 300 people working there, and they depended on this for their livelihood to feed their families through the winter. So basically a full-scale riot ensued. Between the crew of the steamboat and these enraged ice harvesters on the surface of the Milwaukee River in wintertime, it lasted 6 weeks, and it was witnessed by thousands of people. The newspapers all reported on it, and today it's kind of a forgotten story.
Right. Now, this is dangerous for the people fighting out on the breaking up ice there, but add to the surreal element, on the boat it sounds like they had a brass band. And this was huge entertainment for people watching, for sure, a boat with a band and then a brawl on the ice.
Yeah, the boat had sort of a flimsy cover story. The captain of it told the press that he was trying to start a wintertime steamboat excursion service on the river.
Because who wouldn't want to go out on the river on the ice, yeah?
Oh, yeah, totally. Who doesn't want to get out in wintertime and stay on an open steamboat and watch ice being broken? But that's the reason why he had the band. That was sort of his cover story. But, yeah, they had a riot and a brass band going at the same time.
We're talking about Milwaukee's forgotten history with Carl Swanson, author of the new book Lost Milwaukee. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you like to share some history about your community in Milwaukee or anywhere around the state? Is there that forgotten bit of lore, the old building that you know the story behind? Or do you know someone who's really involved in this, digging up the local secrets like that? Call in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about Milwaukee's history, too. 800-642-1234. We'll pick up a conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking to Carl Swanson, author of the new book Lost Milwaukee. We're learning about some of the historic sites in Milwaukee that have been lost to history and modern development. Carl, by the way, speaking tomorrow evening at 7 at Boswell Books in Milwaukee. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions or stories to share about Milwaukee's history or something in your own community, wherever you are around the state? And do you enjoy visiting historic sites around Wisconsin and maybe hearing those forgotten stories? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carl, before we go back to our callers, let's check out another story when Abraham Lincoln came to Milwaukee for the last time.
Yeah, Lincoln's debates with Stephen Douglas had won Lincoln national prominence. His anti-slavery, House Divided speech, it was widely republished and admired throughout the whole state. So it was only natural the directors of the Wisconsin State Fair invited him to come and speak in 1858. This was, of course, before he was president. It's a really funny story connected with that. Lincoln arrived in town after midnight, got to the Newell House Hotel, And the court told him that his room had been given to another person by mistake. So Lincoln told the clerk that he asked that a cot be placed next to the hotel's counter. And he told the clerk, "I have neither insomnia nor indigestion, and I shall sleep like a top." Lincoln's friend arrived the next morning to accompany him to the fairgrounds for his speech. And he found Lincoln shaving behind a folding screen in the lobby, and Lincoln was in high spirits. He had slept very well, and he thought the whole thing was just absolutely hilarious. He got to the fairgrounds and made his speech, which mostly talked about agricultural topics. I mean, it is the State Agricultural Society was his host, after all. But after the speech, I was really taken by sort of the human story of Lincoln and his friend Holt just strolling around the fairgrounds. And among other things, Lincoln took in a sideshow performance for a circus strongman, you know, who's, you know, lifting big weights and he's throwing cannonballs. Lincoln thought this was great. He kept slapping his knee and saying, you know, "By George." And after the show, he asked to meet the performer. And Holt described the performer as wide as he was tall. And Lincoln looked down at the much shorter man and said, "Why, I could lick salt off the top of your hat."
Oh, that's a story. Lincoln in Wisconsin. Let's go back to our callers now. Paul with us on the line in Cambridge. Paul, hi.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm in the Cambridge Historic School Foundation, and something that our curator, Russ Amacher, has done is he's written books on the background of our heritage as far as what buildings were what. He has pictures from the past that were taken like in the 30s and 20s, and he stayed in the exact same space and took the same picture to show the there and now, or now and then, and also the entire community around Cambridge. It's something that we really need to do is preserve the history of our community.
Paul, thank you so much for sharing that story. And Craig, I got to say, I'm a sucker when people put next to each other those, here's a shot from 80 years ago, here's a shot from today, exactly the same spot. And you've got some of the older pictures of the Milwaukee area in there, in your book.
Oh, yeah. There's about 70 old photographs, many of them old-time postcards, a few images from the Wisconsin Historical Society, including an image of the ice war in progress. There's a special fascination to those old photos. You look at the way people dressed, and you see the city as it was, and it's mind-blowing. It's just an incredible experience to look through old photographs like that.
Paul, thanks for sharing that story about Cambridge. We'll go next to Richard in Menominee. Richard, hi.
Hello. I'm driving from 994 on my cell phone, so I hope you can hear me okay.
Loud and clear, Richard. Go for it.
I wanted to let you know that my aunt, Mamie Huffman, was born and raised on a dairy farm outside of Millsville, Wisconsin. She was born in 1893, and she, in the early 20s, she was on the staff of a very prominent family that was part of Pabst. Now, the name was not Pabst. They were in the steel business in Milwaukee, and I think the name started with a B, but they married into the Pabst family, and they were a big part of the Pabst at the time in their heyday. And my aunt could speak German, and she just raved how nice the people were that owned this mansion. So I was just wondering if you heard of that, of the extended Pabst family.
Thanks for the call, Richard. Craig, you've got a chapter on drinking Pabst in Whitefish Bay. I'm sure a lot of people were tied into that Pabst family one way or another.
Yeah, there were, and it's a fairly complex family history, but you know, certainly the experience that your caller just related is very much in keeping with what we know about Captain Frederick Pabst and his family. They were unusually kind, civic-minded people, and if you want me to, I can tell you a little bit about the resort they opened in Whitefish Bay. Which,
sure.
The Pabst Whitefish Bay, it was a beer garden. It covered 200 acres of land overlooking Lake Michigan. Captain Pabst opened the resort in 1889. It had a famous restaurant, hotel, dance hall, daily concerts with a famous band, amusement rides. It was a great location. It was just far enough away from downtown to escape from the heat and the smoke and the noise of the city, but close enough to be reachable by streetcar. Or you could even board a steamboat in downtown Milwaukee, ride down the Milwaukee River, out into the lake, north along the lake shore to the dock, and walk on up to the resort there. In its heyday, 10,000 people would visit the grounds on a typical Sunday.
Wow.
And, yeah, amazing place. But as time passed, the beer garden started to fall out of favor. The resort closed after its 1913 season.
Thanks for the call, Richard. We'll go next to Sandy with us in Mineral Point. Sandy, hi.
Hi. So I was born and raised in Madison, and as a Girl Scout, we did cleanup in the part of the Arboretum called the Lost City. And this was a part of the city where some very expensive lots were sold and some very expensive houses were built. And these very expensive houses had to be abandoned because they sunk into the marsh on the isthmus. So we would find all kinds of really cool stuff out there, foundations and such. And it was really interesting.
Sandy, thank you so much for sharing that. I have heard of that. And Craig, you're a big fan of finding the old foundations and then figuring out what their story was.
I know exactly what she means. That is just like I said, it's a detective story. It's one that you can do yourself. The internet certainly makes it easier to start to uncover some of these answers, but your local library, historical societies, these are all great resources and something that anybody could take advantage of and learn something about their own community.
Sandy, thanks for that call. Carl, as we start to wrap up, does it feel different to live in Milwaukee having done all the detective work you've done?
Yeah, it really does. It really does. It's a kind of a funny thing. I mean, it's really given me a new respect for the hardworking and inventive people that made this community. You think of Milwaukee, I find it a very pleasant place to live. I mean, for sure, it's got a few problems, but it's a welcoming city, and you look back in its history, and you start to see how that reputation was built over time by people that really cared about the city and really cared about each other. It's a very heartwarming story.
We'll leave it there, Carl. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
That's Carl Swanson, author of the book Lost Milwaukee. It uncovers some of the historical sites and lost treasures from the city's past. And Carl is speaking tomorrow evening at 7 at Boswell Books there in Milwaukee.